The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The House Judiciary Committee held an oversight hearing recently on police practices and law enforcement accountability. We're going to hear some testimony from that on today's show. First, Vinita Gupta is the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
While the recent murder of George Floyd at the hands of four Minneapolis police officers put the issue of police brutality in the national spotlight, the outpouring of pain and anger is anything but a reaction to one isolated incident or the misconduct of a few bad apples. Instead, the outcry is a response to the long cycle of stolen lives and violence with impunity toward Black people in our nation. We are now at a turning point. There is no returning to normal. We have to create a new way forward, one that does more than tinker at the edges, that promotes data and training. We need something that truly transforms policing and leads to more accountability for communities. It is imperative that we get this right, and that Congress's response in this moment appropriately reflects and acknowledges the important work of Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, and so many people that are bringing us to this tipping point. My tenure as head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division began 2 months after 18-year-old Michael Brown was killed by a police officer in Ferguson. The Justice Department was hardly perfect, but we understood our mandate to promote accountability and constitutional policing in order to build community trust. During the Obama administration, we opened 25 pattern of practice investigations to help realize greater structural and community-centered change, often at the request of police chiefs and mayors who needed federal leadership. After making findings, we negotiated consent decrees with extensive engagement and input from community advocates who not only identified unjust and unlawful policing practices, but also helped develop sustainable mechanisms for accountability and systemic change. That is not the Justice Department that we have today. Under both Attorneys General Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr, the department has abdicated its responsibility and abandoned the use of tools like pattern practice investigations and consent decrees. Instead, it is focused on dismantling police accountability efforts and halting any new investigations. The disruption of crucial work in the Civil Rights Division and throughout the Department of Justice to bring forth accountability and transparency in policing is deeply concerning. In the absence of federal leadership, the Leadership Conference Education Fund launched the New Era of Public Safety Initiative, a comprehensive guide and toolkit outlining proposals to build trust between communities and police departments, restore confidence, and imagine a new paradigm of public safety. While much of these changes must happen at the state and local level, success is going to require the leadership, support, and commitment of the federal government, including Congress. Last week, the Leadership Conference and more than 400 civil rights organizations sent a letter to Congress to move us forward on a path of true accountability. The recommendations included the following. One, create a national necessary standard on the use of force. Two, prohibit racial profiling, including robust data collection. Three, ban the use of chokeholds and other restraint maneuvers. Four, end the militarization of policing. Five, prohibit the use of no-knock warrants, especially in drug cases. Six, strengthen federal accountability systems and increase the Justice Department's authority to prosecute officers that engage in misconduct. Seven, create a national police misconduct registry. And eight, end qualified immunity. The Leadership Conference was pleased to learn that the Justice and Policing Act introduced Monday by both members of the House of Representatives and the Senate reflects much of this accountability framework. This is Congress's most comprehensive effort in decades to substantially address police misconduct by taking on issues, critical issues affecting Black and brown communities. And as the bill advances toward passage, we will continue to work on it and to ensure that real change is achieved. But let me just say in closing that policing reform alone is not going to solve the crisis that we're in today. This moment of reckoning requires leaders, together with communities, to envision a new paradigm of public safety that respects the human rights of all people. That means not just changing policing practices and culture, but ultimately shrinking the footprint of the criminal legal system in Black and brown people's lives. And it means shifting our approach to public safety from exclusively focusing on criminalization and policing towards investments in economic opportunity, education, healthcare, and other public benefits. Police chiefs and officers talk about the same thing. This approach will not only further equity, but also constitute effective policy. When we stop using criminal justice policy as social policy, we will make communities safer and more prosperous. Now is the time for Congress to pass lasting accountability measures, and we look forward to working with you until the day that these reforms are signed into law. George Floyd's death has impacted the world, and now it is on us to change it. Thank you.
That was Vinita Gupta, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She was testifying at a hearing on policing practices and law enforcement accountability that was held recently by the House Judiciary Committee. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center.
There has never, not for 1 minute in American history, been peace between black people and the police. And nothing since slavery has sparked the level of outrage among African Americans as when they feel under violent attack by the police. Black people have endured Jim Crow segregation, being shut out of Social Security and the GI Bill, massive resistance to school desegregation, nonstop efforts to prevent us from voting, and poison water. But the rare times black people have set aside traditional civil rights strategies and instead have risen in the streets, destroyed property, and resisted symbols of the state has been because of something that the police have done. Watson 65, Newark in 67, Miami 1980, LA 1992, Ferguson 2015, Baltimore 2016, Minneapolis in 2020. All of those cities went up in flames because the police killed another black man. Unlawful violence is never acceptable, either as a misguided approach of a few or as an abuse of the power and trust we place in law enforcement officers. The main problem is not bad apple cops. Officers have difficult jobs and many serve with honor and valor. Still, almost every objective investigation of a police department finds that police, as policy, treat African Americans with contempt. The police kill, wound, pepper spray, beat up, detain, frisk, handcuffs, and use dogs against black people in circumstances in which they do not do the same to white people. When armed agents of the state are harming American citizens in our name, we the people must ask why. In the past 2 weeks, we've seen acts of grace and bravery by police officers. Cops in New York took a knee. In Houston, Chief Acevedo arranged for an honor guard to accompany Mr. Floyd's body when he came home. Unfortunately, we have also witnessed these past 2 weeks police officers commit deplorable acts of violence against the citizens they've sworn to serve and protect. In New York, officers drove two large police vehicles into a crowd of protesters. In Atlanta, officers broke the window of a car, dragged out two college students, and shot them with a stun gun in Buffalo. A police officer knocked a 75-year-old man to the ground, but what happened next was just as bad. When two officers were disciplined for that criminal conduct, 57 other officers quit the squad in protest. President Obama's task force on policing decried the warrior mentality present among too many law enforcement officers. In Buffalo, the nation saw warriors on steroids. African American and Hispanic people disproportionately bear the cost. Blacks are about 20% of the population of Minneapolis, but 60% of the people who cops use violence against. The result is that there are more black people in the criminal legal system today than there were slaves in 1850. When I mentioned to a young man I mentor that if he attended protests, he should wear a mask, he said he certainly would try. But he wanted me to know that as a young black man, he has a greater risk of dying from police violence than from the coronavirus. According to the National Academy of Science, 1 in 1,000 African American men and boys will be killed by the police. What African Americans need to realize equal justice under the law is for selective enforcement and police brutality to end. We need the police to stop killing us, to stop beating us up, to stop arresting us in situations in which they would not do those things to white people. The Justice in Policing Act is a common sense reform. Among other things, it requires cops to be trained on understanding racial bias. In Minneapolis, as three officers crushed the life out of Mr. Floyd, and another served as a lookout, somebody in the crowd said to the cops, "He's human, bro." But these four officers did not treat Mr. Floyd like a human being. Too often, police work seems to enforce the dehumanization of people of color. Understanding the history and reality of racism in the United States will make our men and women in blue more effective officers. In the end, this hearing is about the legitimacy and sustainability of our democracy. No justice, no peace is not a threat. It is simply a description of how the world works. The multiracial, multigenerational demonstrations that have risen up all over the United States reflect the wonderful diversity of our great nation and the potential of ordinary citizens to make our country live up to its highest ideals. The Justice and Policing Act of 2020 heralds the urgency of transformation and the promise for all Americans of equal justice under the law.
That was Professor Paul Butler, a former federal prosecutor who is currently the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center. Now here's Professor Butler outlining his Ten Commandments for Black Men.
If you're an African-American man, police and prosecutors are coming for you. I know this because I was a prosecutor. It was my job to lock up black men. I am also a black man, and cops treat me like one. I've been stopped and frisked more times than I can count, thrown against a cop car twice, and worst of all, I was arrested and prosecuted for a crime I didn't commit. I beat my case because I know how to work the system. Now I want you to know what I know. I can't take back all those brothers who I locked up, but now I'm a law professor at Georgetown, and I can help people avoid the chokehold of police and prosecutors. Here are the Ten Commandments for Black Men. This is real talk for how to get the police to leave you alone, and if you do catch a case, how to deal with a system that is out to get you. These tips are focused on black men, but we're not the only people who get mistreated. Black women and other groups also have big problems, and these Ten Commandments will work for them too. Stop and frisk is a joke. Stop and frisk is when the cops roll up and pat you down. The law says they can't do that unless they have reasonable suspicion. The street says 12 can stop you for almost anything. Police don't need a real reason, and in many cases, they just make one up. Here are some of the things cops tell me make them start looking at a brother hard. A black man in a black SUV. Three or more black men in a car. A black man running. A black man with a white woman. A black man in a Black Lives Matter t-shirt. I'm not saying don't do these things. I'm just saying be aware of the biases we face as black men. And if you don't want to deal with the cops, act like you know. Keep your cool. An arrest will change your life. So be smart when the police stop you. If you get stopped, the cop wants to dominate you. You have to play along if you want to avoid an arrest. You have to give them that respect, even if they don't deserve it. Say, "Officer, sir, and ma'am." Ask politely.
"Officer, am I free to go?"
If they say no, don't curse or lose your cool. That will only make things worse. Don't admit to anything. Cops lie. If they say, "Just tell us what you did and we'll let you go."
Don't trust that.
If they say, "We know it was self-defense."
Don't trust that.
If they say, "We know you were just holding it for somebody else."
Definitely do not trust that.
If they ask if they can search you and you have anything on you, just say no. People do that and it's stupid. You trying to get locked up or what? You have the right to shut the hell up. Everybody's heard of Miranda rights.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you tell police can be used against you in a court. You have the right to an attorney. If you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you.
If the police don't read you your rights, that's not a get out of jail free card. It just means they can't use your statement against you if you go to trial. If the cops arrest you, you can't talk your way out. That didn't even work for me, and I was a prosecutor. The best thing to do is shut the hell up. Repeat like a sample. If they read you your rights, say this and nothing but this.
I invoke my right to silence and my right to a lawyer. I will not talk to you without a lawyer.
If the cops keep trying, say it again.
I invoke my right to silence and my right to a lawyer. I will not talk to you without a lawyer.
Don't say another freaking word about the case. Call your mother. If you do get locked up, they usually let you make a call. If you have a lawyer, call them first. If not, call your mom, your girl, a boy, your cousin, anyone that'll stop what they're doing to deal with the mess your life has just become. So you have a public defender? Chill. A lot of times they have way more courthouse experience than a paid lawyer. But let's keep it real. Some appointed lawyers are lousy, and if you have major concerns about your appointed counsel, there comes a time to hire a paid lawyer, especially if the charges are serious. Here are three things a good defense attorney should do for you. Thing one, your lawyer should file a motion for your release. They should ask the judge to dismiss the case. You'll probably lose. Judges almost never drop cases. But in the hearing, your lawyer will learn more about the prosecution's case. And if the cops don't show up, the case might get dismissed. Thing two, your lawyer should ask the prosecutor for discovery and Brady. If your lawyer says, "What's that?" run for the hills, my dude. Thing three, your lawyer should hire an investigator. This way you can get a version of the facts that doesn't come straight from the police. To snitch or not to snitch? That is the question. The prosecution might offer you a deal. If you're thinking about snitching, you're going to want to check off three boxes first. Nobody gets hurt. Don't snitch if somebody's going to get got. It's worth it. Don't snitch unless you get to go home or get less time. It's the right thing to do. Don't snitch if you have to lie or incriminate somebody you care about. Dress to impress. When I was a prosecutor, we used to crack up at how some defendants dressed in court. They made our jobs easy because they looked guilty. Baggy pants, a white t-shirt, gold chain, sneakers. When a black man has his fate in the hands of a judge or jury, he needs to wear a suit and polished shoes. Trust me, bro, judges and juries notice. Take the stand or take the fifth. If you go to trial, taking the stand is your decision, but be sure to listen to your lawyer's advice. Understand that a good prosecutor can make an innocent person look guilty. That's why your lawyer might want you to take the fifth. If you choose to testify, keep your answers short and to the point. The prosecutor will try to get you heated. Don't fall for it. Throw yourself on the mercy of the court. Let's say you lose. Sorry, my dude. A lot of brothers have been in this situation. More than 500,000 at this very moment, to be exact. So what's next? Your sentencing. Time for the most important performance of your life. Get your teachers, boss, and pastor to write letters. Then have them and your whole family, except kids, show up in court. When judges see people there for you, in your corner, it helps. Prepare a statement where you say you're sorry. This judge has your whole life in their hands. You got to get them to see the whole you, not just what happened on that horrible day when you caught this case. If this all feels like a horror flick, that's how the criminal legal process is for African Americans. The country that black men live in is not free. The next time you see those flashing lights or the cops step up to you in the street, remember these commandments. The black man in the horror movie is usually the first to die. You can be that brother who survives.
That was Professor Paul Butler with his Ten Commandments for Black Men. Audio came to us courtesy of the Georgetown University Law Center. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, a handful of people on social media have tried to make something out of George Floyd's criminal record, tried to use his past to somehow justify his murder. It's grotesque, and it's wrong, and they're even making up lies to do it. Now, I was asked to research his cases. I looked over records at the Harris County District Court, and what I found is that George Floyd was wronged repeatedly and badly by the Texas criminal justice system. He was preyed upon repeatedly by the Houston Police Department. What they did to George Floyd shows just how corrupt and awful the system is. One arrest for supposedly selling less than a gram of cocaine was definitely bogus. He got framed by a crooked cop named Gerald Goines. Gerald Goines was a Houston police officer who lied, manufactured evidence, ruined the lives of countless Houstonians with false arrests. He got two innocent people killed in the infamous Harding Street raid in January 2019. That's when things really fell apart for Officer Goines and his partner Steve Bryant and the whole of Houston Police Department's Narcotic Squad 15. Gerald Goines is named as the undercover in the 2004 alleged cocaine deal, supposedly the sale of less than a gram. George Floyd was notified in March of 2019 that his case was one of the ones being investigated. Now, the very first time that George Floyd was arrested in 1997, that was also for allegedly selling less than a gram of cocaine to an undercover cop. Cop's word against his. He pleads no contest. He got a state jail felony sentence of 180 days with credit for 29 days time served. Did he really do it? Doubtful. It was 1997. What is a narcotics cop in Houston, bloody Texas, doing making dime bag buy busts in the first place? That's a rhetorical question. Obviously, what he was doing is ruining lives and fueling the Texas prison system, adding one more number to a growing body count. The point is, that first offense, that first jail sentence, was probably a bogus charge. Now, about the assault conviction, the one that certain right-wing media like the Daily Mail were going to town over. There's no question, to me at least, that George Floyd was railroaded in that case. The charge was aggravated assault with a weapon. It happened on August 9, 2007, a home invasion of sorts. A witness had seen people getting out of a black Ford Explorer and entering the house. Little over 3 months later, on November 15th of 2007, a couple of unnamed narcotics cops claimed that they happened upon that black Ford Explorer, and lo and behold, it's being driven by George Floyd. More than 3 months later. I mean, already this stinks. This is all according to the affidavit in support of bringing the charges. The narcs notify Officer Jay Tapia from Houston's robbery division. Officer Tapia brings in the two witnesses, shows them a photo array, gets the victim to tentatively identify Mr. Floyd as her attacker. And so they get to arrest him and bring him in. Now, there's no physical evidence. There's no forensics. They're claiming that he held on to a vehicle that had been used in a home invasion for more than 3 months after the fact. Police officers then manipulate the eyewitnesses more than 3 months after it happened into making tentative identifications. It's America, and that's enough. He fit the profile. So they arrest him. There's a high cash bail, and he can't get out unless you pay, and bad media coverage, and there's brutal cops, deceptive and corrupt prosecutors. This story plays out countless times in cities and counties around the country. Houston and Harris County, far from the exception. But for a long time, it was one of the worst. When George Floyd finally copped a plea on that assault, he was sentenced to 5 years in a Texas prison. He was given credit for almost a full year of time served in Harris County Jail, which is a horribly overcrowded and awful facility. He didn't plead guilty because he was guilty. He took a plea because he wanted to eventually get out from behind bars. He didn't want to die in jail. Like I said, an editor at Workforce has assigned me to do this research. Folks who follow me on social media have seen bits and bobs from it. But now here's the thing. George Floyd's background doesn't matter. He was murdered, period. His record is utterly irrelevant. He was murdered by police. It was wrong. But for what it's worth, he was probably not guilty of the crimes he'd been convicted of. Judgments, guilty pleas be damned. Our system coerces confessions and guilty pleas out of people all the time. No one should be surprised by this. The criminal justice system preyed on George Floyd his whole life. And in Minneapolis, the system finally took his life. George Floyd's case, his murder, it's not the exception. It's been the rule. Rules. Yeah, I mentioned Bruce Harvey's rules of police earlier. 1. Cops lie. 2. Cops always lie. 3. Cops always lie about drugs. So true today. And in fact, well, it's time to add a 4th rule. Rule number 4. Cops always lie about everything. And that's why people are protesting. This is why people are demanding that the rules, the whole bloody system, has to change fundamentally and wholly. Because George Floyd's life mattered. Because black lives matter. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, while we still have time, let's hear from Dr. Philip Goff. Philip Atiba Goff, Ph.D., is the inaugural Franklin A. Thomas Professor in Policing Equity at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's co-founder and president of the Center for Policing Equity, and he's an expert in contemporary forms of racial bias and discrimination, as well as the intersections of race and gender.
I have to say that what we have seen in the streets of the United States over the past 2 weeks nearly defies description. It's Some have called it massive protest. Others have called it a riot. Others have called it a revolution. What I am confident is that what we have seen has been larger than the incident that sparked collective outrage and is still tearing at the fabric of our democracy. What has spilled out onto the streets of this nation is even larger than our grief at the brutal extinction of George Floyd's life and the light of the 1,000 citizens per year killed by police, a number that has not changed significantly since newspapers began cataloging those numbers in 2015. What we're seeing on the streets of the United States is a past due notice for the unpaid debts owed to Black people for 400 plus years. If the responses to this moment are not proportional to that debt, I fear we will continue to pay it with interest again and again and again. Turning to the complex issue of police reform, I applaud the work of Chairman Nadler and Congresswoman Bass for putting forth a comprehensive proposal to rethink how we best hold law enforcement accountable to the ideal of equality. The Justice and Policing Act of 2020 contains a number of critical reforms, including banning neck restraints and creating a national registry of police misconduct. In my capacity at CPE, however, I want to spend a moment focusing on what science says about bias in policing. I feel it's important to set a baseline, especially with all of the false information circulating in media, given the general vacuum in the ecosystem on evidence in this area. First, there is no doubt that Black, Native, and Latinx people in this country have more contact with law enforcement than do white people. There's also relative agreement that where there are fewer public services, so fewer drug treatment, mental health, job training programs, law enforcement has more contact with residents. There is evidence of racial bias in who was contacted by police and who was targeted for force. However, it is also the case that clearly not all the disparities we see are from police policy or behavior. It is some, but not all. Given this understanding of bias in policing, what are we to do? As we've already heard today, the most recent debate is between institutional reform and defunding the police. While there is no quantitative research literature on abolishing policing, there are reasons to believe that many within Black communities are not fully aligned with this vision. Historical and polling research reveal that Black communities support less biased and less deadly law enforcement more than eliminating it. With the mood of the nation changing so quickly, so too may these attitudes. And still, to the degree that a path forward involves using police budgets to invest in Black communities, the process must be led by evidence. Evidence about what programs work, both in policing and in communities, and evidence about where cities can safely receive a higher return on their investment in community empowerment. And regardless, there is no need to wait for a decision on police budgets to invest in our most vulnerable communities. Wherever the country lands on police budgets, we can all agree the communities that have the resources to solve their own problems and do not need to call the police in the first place are safer communities that are better equipped to realize the American dream. There is no reason to avoid this obvious truth, and there is no reason not to act on it now.
That was Professor Philip Atiba Goff, Ph.D., co-founder and president of the Center for Policing Equity. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.